Good morning. Good morning. It is still morning, isn't it? Yeah. My name is A.J. McLaughlin, and I'm a very grateful member of the Fellowship of Al-Anon. I want to thank Milton and the committee for allowing me to share my story with you all. It is a privilege. It truly is a privilege, and those are not just words. I mean it. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be any place where there's an Al-Anon meeting, but I'm glad to be here. You know, we got a lot of recovery here last night when they were going down, you know, a lot of recovery. It's really great. My home group is a Sunday Night Shively group in Louisville, Kentucky. And I want to talk a little bit about that because it's a night meeting and I can no longer drive at night. I can't see at night, so it's kind of dangerous for me to drive. And you know, I'm having a problem changing home groups. I had the same home group for 20-something years. And I'm having a hard time. And you know, and we're lucky in Louisville, we have a lot of really good day meetings. But I'm still really having a hard time. I guess, you know, it's hard to get away from people that have loved you and carried you for a number of years, and my home group has seen me through some really bad times, and good times, too. So, but it'll work out. God will take care of it. And whichever one I get will be the right one for me. Our program suggests that we tell what our life was like and what happened and what it's like today. And as I've gotten older, I've talked more about what life is like today than what it was like, but I will say enough to so you will know how I got here. I'm the oldest of three children. I have a younger brother and sister. We're all still alive and we all love each other. We're very close. My dad died when I was 6 years old. We had to move in with my grandmother and grandfather at in a neighborhood that was poor. But you know, I had a good childhood. Everybody in the neighborhood was poor. We didn't have a park to play in, but we had empty lots, and we all went to the same school together, and well, it worked out great. You know, I really had a good childhood. We had a lot of parties in my family. I grew up in a Catholic family, and we celebrated by drinking beer. That was our choice. We celebrated birthdays and first communions and confirmations and Mondays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And so there's a lot of beer drinking that went on in my family. But, you know, I don't remember anybody getting in trouble from that. I really don't. I found out when I grew up, my mother told me that two of her brothers died from active alcoholism when they were in their 40s. And then I knew them as two uncles who were distant and never around, or they didn't stay around very long. That was my only memory of them. So. Anyway, I went to a all-boys high school downtown Louisville, and there were guys from all over the city that came to this school, and I made a lot of friends, and then some of my friends were guys who lived in a different part of town, who lived in nice homes, and their family had nice cars, and you know, I liked that. And I bring that up in this Al-Anon talk because I made up my mind at that age that I was going to do whatever was necessary. When I became an adult and started my working life, I was going to do whatever I had to do to live like they did. And as a consequence, I became a workaholic. And that's not a good situation in my family thing, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. After I got out of high school, I was in the Army for several years in World War II. And after I got out of the Army, I decided to go to college, and that was alien to my family's history. I remember one of my cousins said, it's kind of like I was going to the moon or something, you know. But anyway, I did. I went to college, and you know, and I couldn't wait to get out because I'd been in the Army all these years, and here I'm in college, and I'm waiting on tables and typing manuscripts and don't have any money, and I was really in a hurry to get out and get to work, you know, and so I finished in 3 years, which really wasn't a very good idea because college is a hell of a lot more fun than some other things, working and stuff, you know, but anyway, that's what I did. And shortly after I got out of college, a few years, a little bit, I met my wife-to-be, Now, she came from a family that was diametrically opposed to my family. Her family was wealthy. Her family owned 2 distilleries. Their drink of choice was bourbon, and they drank a lot of it too. But we courted, and we decided to get married. And you need to be careful before you get married what you talk about, because we decided that we wanted to have a lot of children, and God hears you when you. And so we got married, and 10 years later we had 7 children. And at the time it was difficult, but I'm so grateful now. But anyway, after we had our first baby, the company I was working for transferred me down to Houston to open a new plant down there. And we were gung-ho to go and everything. But we got down there and we started having these babies on a regular basis. And I'm a workaholic. I want to be a success. I want to be like those kids that I grew up with that had more than I did. And so I worked long hours, and my excuse was, well, it's necessary to get this plant going and all this kind of business. And my wife was home taking care of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all these kids. And she tried to tell me, I need more from you than you're giving me. These kids don't have very intelligent conversations. And to my eternal regret, I could not or did not or couldn't understand what she was trying to tell me. And so I kept going down my path of working long hours. But at that time, I was a good father. I really was a good father. I helped my wife take care of the kids. I bathed them. I helped them with their schoolwork. I played with them. And I was a good father. Later on, I was not a good father, but I was not a good husband. And sometime in that 14 years that we lived in Houston, my wife, and she said this later, that in order for her to survive, she needed to start using alcohol to keep her going. And she did. And after we were in Houston for 14 years, my company said to me, would you like a transfer back to Louisville and a promotion? And I said, of course. And I didn't talk to Sue about this or anything. So I went home and told her, we're moving back to Louisville. And my thinking was that we're going back to Louisville and her family's there and my family's there and things are going to get better. Now, you all are familiar with geographical cures. There is no such thing, We go with our mood. We got to Louisville, and we bought a nice, great big house, and quit the kids in school, and my wife and I's relationship just kept getting worse, kept deteriorating. Neither one of us really knew what the hell we were doing, except that it wasn't working. In the period between the mid-60s and 1985, my wife was in Our Lady of Peace Hospital for depression 2 or 3 different times. In the 1980, and my wife is drinking all this period of time. She never drank in bars, she drank at home. And there was a period of time when I was a plant manager and I had 3 shifts working for me and I had to be there from 6:30 in the morning till 6:30 at night approximately, because I had to cover all shifts. And my wife smoked, and I needed sleep, so I would go upstairs to go to bed, and I lay there and I couldn't sleep because I knew she was downstairs drinking and smoking. And so, sometimes I'd go down there and she'd be passed out and the cigarettes lit, and I had all these little kids, and that was a bad time. It was really a bad time. Anyway, in 1980, our oldest son, who was 24 years old, took his own life. And I don't know anything that can happen worse to a family than losing a child, particularly to violence. And from 1980 to 1985, when my wife decided she needed help and we got in the program, our life was living hell. My wife felt that she was responsible. I felt that I was responsible. It didn't make any difference what anybody told us. We felt like we were responsible. And I remember this young priest who was a friend of mine telling me, that Mike was an adult, he made his own decisions, and I said, yeah, but it didn't get through at all. And in 1980, Sue decided that she'd had enough and that she was going to go into treatment, and I remember saying, yeah, okay. And the problem was, at that point in my life, I was, and you all will recognize this, I was a miserable wreck. You know, I hated everybody and everything. I was nasty to be around. But you know, worse than anything else, I had given up. I didn't care anymore. And that's awful. That's a terrible place to be. And I will never be there again. I don't have to because my program won't let me. But that's an awful place to be. And so Sue goes into the treatment center, and I go in to visit her, and she's in such bad shape physically that she had it's a 4-week program. The first week they don't do anything except try to build her strength up. And she hands me these papers, and she said, "This is for the family program." And I said, "Well, I don't need that." You know, and I was sincere. You know, I didn't think I needed that. The problem was Sue. If she quit drinking, we'd be all right. She said, "Well, the doctor thinks it'd be a good idea if you'd go to this family program." And I respected her doctor. So I said, "Okay, I'll give it a shot." Well, this is it. At that time, in this hospital, they had a beautiful family program. It covered many hours during 3 or 4 or 5 days in a week. It was on a weekend. It was lengthy. And I went to this first session on a Tuesday. It was an all-day session. And during that session was the first time I had cried. This lady, who was just a beautiful human being, said, "How do you feel?" She said to me, "How do you feel?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm numb. I don't have any feeling." She said, "Oh, yes, you do. You got them in there." And we started talking, and I started crying. That's the first time I had done that for a long, long time. And then towards the end of the day, she said, "Tonight there's a newcomer Al-Anon meeting. And I suggested all of you go." And then when I'm leaving, she stops me and she said, "I want you to go for sure," you know, to go. So yeah, I said, "Okay, all right, I'll go." So I get to it's downstairs in the basement of this hospital, and I get there and I look in the door, and you know, I really belong in the Al-Anon because you'll recognize this. I look in the door, and I count. There's 21 women in there. 21 women. So, you know, my first thought was, "Man, I don't want to go in there. They don't know how I feel or anything else, and this is just a waste of time, and I'm going home." And I thought, "Nah, I told Sue I'd go." So I go in there, you know, and God takes care of us. He really does. I have no clue what the program was or anything else. I still see the lady who chaired. Isn't that great? 25 years later, I still see her. But anyway, towards the end of the meeting, she said, "Does anybody have anything, any questions or anything?" And I held my hand up, and I said, "Yeah." I said, "My wife's a patient upstairs, and she tells me that she's an alcoholic, and she says it's my fault." And I said, "I think she's right." Well, we were sitting at long tables, and there was 2 or 3 women sitting across from me, and this one lady says to me, she said, "I don't know you. I've never met you. You know, I don't know whether you're a father or a husband or what you are or what kind of a human being you are or anything else, but let me tell you something. If, in fact, your wife is an alcoholic, you are not responsible. And if you'd like to talk about that a little bit, we'll stay after the meeting and talk to you." And I said, "Yeah, I really would appreciate that." And you know what? 3 ladies sat across from me at that table for 30 minutes after that meeting and told me about Al-Anon. You know, this is a program of hope. When I left that meeting, I had some hope. And I sure as hell didn't have any when I walked in that meeting. Not a bit. But I had someone I left. Now, my wife said when she got out of treatment, she's going to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, "Yeah, sure, I bet you do." And you know she didn't. She probably went to 150 meetings. She loved AA. I really, truly believe that she waited all her life for AA. She just loved it. You know, she got a home group, a woman's group. She made a lot of friends. She got a sponsor. And it was just, and you could see her change physically and emotionally and spiritually. And I'm still a basket case because I'm full of fear. I am so full of fear. I'll give you a short example. Sue would go to the grocery in the morning. Now, I don't know how long it takes you to go to the grocery. Depends on what you're going to get, I guess. I would time her, and she's always late. Didn't make any difference how long she's gone. She's always late, you know? I mean, that's how crazy I was. And you all, some of you will recognize that, you know. You've been there, you know. So, but anyway, the one thing that I did right the first year and a half was I went to a lot of meetings. I went to a lot of meetings, you know, and just a lot of it went in and out and everything else. But, you know, after about a year and a half, I finally began to understand that Al-Anon was for me. It didn't have anything to do with my wife. Didn't have anything to do with whether she drank or not. Didn't have anything to do with my kids and what they were doing that I didn't like. Didn't have to do with anything in my life except me and what kind of a human being I wanted to be and what kind of life I wanted to live. And you know what? That's what I needed to understand. And from that time on, I began to get better. Now, about this same time, there was some, we were, my wife and I were in a couples group, and we got to be pretty close, and this is about a year and a half, and then we were having this meeting, and this guy says to me, "Who's your sponsor?" And, you know, and I didn't have a sponsor, so I figured it wasn't any of his damn business, you know, so. Well, these were loving people. I'm serious about this. So they said, "You have to get a sponsor, you ding-dong. You need to use." And so there was this one guy in there that had a really good program. I really didn't like him very much personally. Still don't, but, you know. So I said to him, "Would you be my sponsor?" And he looked at me. Now, he'd been to a lot of meetings with me, you know, and he said, "Oh, man," he said, "I'll try it on a temporary basis if you do what I tell you to do." "Oh, don't worry about it. I'll be glad to tell you. I mean, you just tell me what you want, you know, and I'll do this." And he said, "Well, the first thing is that I want you to call me several times a week." And I said, "Well, wait a minute." I said, "I don't like the phone." And he said, now this is a good start. And he says to me, "I don't like to use the phone either, and I'm pretty damn sure I'm not going to enjoy talking to you." Now, that's getting off to a good start, you know? I mean, he was nothing if not totally honest. But he said to me, and these were the key words that he ever said to me, "You will work the steps, and I will show you and tell you how to work the steps." And he said, and so I say to him, you know, I'm still gung-ho, and I said, "Well, we don't have to go to the first two because they apply to my wife, but they don't apply to me. We can start with three." "I don't think so." He said, "I think we'll start with one." And he said, "Let me tell you something. I have been in enough meetings with you to know that you are not going to move on to step two until you and I both are satisfied that you truly understand and appreciate the impact of step one." Because he said, "I know you." And you know, he was totally right. And I remember a lady saying to me in a meeting, "We're powerless over people, places, and things." Now, this is pretty early on, and I thought, "Well, man, that's ridiculous. I'm responsible for people, places, and things. What are you talking about? I'm powerless over that, you know." So my sponsor says to me, he said, "You will chair meetings, and when you do, you'll talk about the first step." He said, "You will talk to old-timers every chance you get about the first step. You will read literature about the first step, and you will learn what the first step really means for a poor, sick alcoholic, alima like you." He wasn't very sympathetic, but you know, he was absolutely right. And it took me months, literally months, to get through the first step because I really, truly had a problem. I thought incorrectly that I had some control. I thought, you know, that I had control over my wife, that I had control over my kids and a lot of other situations. And of course, as time went on, I began to understand I really didn't have any control at all. I just flat didn't. I remember one time in a meeting, somebody asked me about my kids, and I said, "Well, you know, I got four of them, and I got six of them, and four of them are okay, but the other two, I'm having a problem getting straightened out." And this lady says to me, "What the hell are you talking about, having a problem getting them straightened out? Are they adults?" I said, "Yeah." She says, "None of your damn business." You know, I thought, she can't be right. She can't be right. You know, what are they going to do if I don't show them what and tell them what to do? And then she says to me the words that really jolted me. She said, "If you didn't do your job when they're young, it's too late now." And she was absolutely right. She was absolutely right, you know. But I finally got to where I needed to be, to John's satisfaction and mine in the first step. And that was to get through all the stuff, to understand that I am powerless, to accept that I am powerless, and for me to understand that being powerless was a gift. A true gift, because it freed me. It truly freed me. Now, that took a long time. So he said, "Now, you're going to do the same thing on the second and third steps, and I'm not going to go through all the steps." But essentially, I did the same thing through all the steps with his guidance and help. And he and I very rarely agreed on very much. But, you know, this is what we're doing, and it's working. My wife is getting better. We went to this couples meeting to develop a relationship that we had lost. And through a lot of hard work, and I mean hard work, we did develop that relationship again. We learned to talk to each other again, you know. So all this thing. So I'm not sure exactly where I want to go right now, but I'm changing. You know, we change in this program or we don't make it, you know, and I'm changing, and I can remember specific situations in my recovery in months or years down the road where something would happen, I would act or say something, and I would realize, literally understand and be aware that this is not the way I used to do this, and this is better. This is a better way. This happened to me several times, and so I was conscious of changing, but not how or what, but you know, it doesn't make any difference. I did what my sponsor told me to do, what other people told me to do, and I was becoming a different human being, and I liked that. And you know, at some point in this, let me back up a minute, I want to tell you. After we'd been in the program for 7 years, and I was trying to make amends to my kids, because when they were teenagers, I was not a good father. I was a tyrant. I really, really was not a good father. Now, some of my kids lived in California, and some of them lived in Texas, and some of them lived in Florida, so I'm doing this long distance, stuff. It was okay, but except for two of them, and two of them were hard-headed like their mother, and they did not want to listen to me. They just didn't want to listen to me for whatever reason. And so I talked this over with Sue, and I said, you know, I'm really trying, but I'm not doing very good here. And so we decided that we would have a family reunion. One of my daughters lived on a ranch in Mount Shasta, California, up in the mountains. Beautiful, beautiful place. And so she said, okay, we can have the family reunion on the ranch. And so we did, and there was 20-something of us out there. Beautiful place, beautiful. And you know what I remember mostly about that? We did hike through the mountains, and we did some target shooting, and we went horseback riding. But what I remember the most is we sat around in the yard for hours and talked. For hours, you know. And at the end of that week, we were a family again. What a gift. What a gift. And ever since that time, we have a family reunion every 2 years, and it has kept us a family again, because my family scattered all over, and that the cousins get to renew their friendship with their other cousins, and we all get to see each other. And the last family reunion we had last June in Georgia, and I had a great, great granddaughter, 7 months old, and she was the star. I guarantee you that, she was the star. Anyway, our life started changing. You know, as a consequence of these changes at this point in my life, my kids love me again. And not only that, they like me. That's a good deal. They like me. You know, I had friends. By the time I got to the program, I didn't have any friends anymore because I just sloughed them aside. Besides that, they didn't want to be around me with my personality. I had a lot of friends. A lot of friends. Friends everywhere, you know. My wife and I were friends again. You know, we get these gifts from the program if we change, if we do what we're told to do. Sue and I grew up together in the AA and Al-Anon program. We began to travel. We both liked to travel. I loved horse racing. We belonged to a national racing club, and we went all over the country to races. Santa Anita and Gulfstream and other places, and just enjoyed life. And every place we went to meetings. We went to Florida usually January and February, and I had a home group down there, and she had a home group down there. We went to a lot of conferences. We had a life, a beautiful life, as a result of our programs. We were in Pensacola, Florida, and I think it was 1999, winter. And Sue got sick, and we went to one of these clinics, which they were not able to help us. And when we came back home, she went to our family doctor, and he took some x-rays, and he called, and he said, I want to see both of you all. And we came in, and he told us that Sue had terminal cancer. She had tried 3 different times, truly tried to quit smoking, and she just couldn't do it. She had lung cancer and liver cancer, and so the doctor said, now I'm going to send you all to a clinic because I want this verified. And so we went to the clinic, and the same thing. And And the doctor said 3 to 6 months, and the clinic said 3 to 8 months, and Sue lived 8 months. But anyway, she said to me, I want to die at home if I can, and I want to die with a minimum of pain. And she died at home, and she died with a minimum of pain, and there's no question in my mind at all that the prayers of my immediate family and our AA and Al-Anon families, God gave her those two gifts that she wanted. There's just no question in my mind at all. I took her to her home group meeting till she couldn't walk. We had meetings in our house. My wife never complained. She never, ever, ever, ever said that why me or anything else. I remember when we called hospice in, and there was a nurse and a chaplain and somebody else, and the nurse says to Sue, my wife, said, how are you doing? And she said, well, I'm doing okay, but he's a basket case, you know. And she was right, you know, she was. But I told my kids later, she taught us how to die. She truly did. And her funeral service was, for all practical purposes, an AA meeting. That's what she wanted, so that her children would understand how much she loved AA. Her sponsor talked, two couples talked, and I talked. And it was a beautiful ceremony. It truly was. You know, and we ended with our prayers that we always end with, and I remember in my home group, I was talking to a friend, a lady friend of mine, she had lost her husband several years before, and I said, Nancy, I'm really scared. I've never lived alone, and I'm an old man, and I've never lived alone. I'm really scared of living alone. And she said, well, it'll probably be okay, but I don't know. I guess it will be. She said, all you can do is do it, you know. So I did do it, and you know, it was okay. It was okay. I don't like it. Still don't like it, but it was okay. I was able to live with it. I could cook and do the things that I need to do to survive, and so that part was okay. You know, we grieve in different ways, or I grieved in different ways. When my son died, I had a lot of anger and guilt, and I remember strong, strong, strong feelings of these things when my son died. And as I said, we lived in hell for 5 years till we got in the program and somebody could help us. But you know, what Sue and I grieved together during her illness. And so when she died, it was okay. You know, we knew it was going to happen. It's part of life, and it was okay. But I was grieving, and I guess sometimes you're not conscious that you're grieving. One of the ways that I know is that we always had a lot of music in our house. We had everything from operas to classical to country music to, you know, all everything. And I didn't play any music in my house for 14 months after Sue died. And I went to a day meeting, and on the way home, I decided I'm gonna. So I got home and I put a Patsy Cline CD on, you know. And I said, you know, I think I'm getting better. You know, I think I'm getting better. And as I mentioned before, I loved horse racing. A friend of mine called and said, we're forming a partnership to buy a racehorse. You want to be involved? And I said, oh, sure. Yeah, I'd love to be involved. So we bought this horse. He had good breeding. Great, big, beautiful horse. Just absolutely beautiful. And I remember he ran his first race at Churchill Downs. And one of my sons and his wife were there. And we were standing on the finish line. And I was standing on a chair. And our horse won by 12 lengths. And my son said to me, Pop, you were 6 feet off of that chair when that horse came. An old guy told me one time in a horse racing business, he said, man, there's no thrill like being part of a horse that wins a race. Well, this horse was a strange horse. I think he was smarter than most humans. He was big and fast, and as a consequence, he got hurt a lot. So what he did, he took every winter off. He didn't work every winter. He went to Florida every winter season. But he only ran 10 times in his life. He won 4 times. If he didn't win, he didn't do anything at all. But he made enough money that when we had to put him down because he broke his leg, we got money back. So it was a good experience, a totally pleasurable experience, you know. And during this time, I'm still going to a lot of meetings because that's what keeps me going. About 3 years after Sue died, there was a group of us who went to dinner every Tuesday night. We called this our bereavement group. We had all lost somebody. And this lady joined our group, and her husband and I used to work together, and Sue and I had been out with this couple and other couples with dinner a few times. And so she joined our group, and one night we were talking, and she said to me, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, I'm going to Churchill Downs. And she said, I haven't been for 30 years. And I said, let's go. And so we did, and that started a relationship. I found out that she liked to dance, and I loved to dance, and God, she could really dance. She was really good. And in Louisville, at that time, this was a few years ago, and I'm sure it's still true, there, if you're a senior, 3 or 4 afternoons a week, live music for 2 hours, you can dance. And we made every one of them. I mean, and it was great. It was really great. We went on a cruise together. We went to, on Florida to vacation together. Now, she had, one of my sons says, Pop, you going to marry her? And I said, well, I don't think so, and I don't think she thinks so. She lives at home. She got this beautiful house and 20 acres of land, gorgeous. And but she's got 2 40-year-old sons living at home with her. And I said, I don't want any part of that. And, you know, and I think that, and she didn't want to move from there, and I can understand that because it was a really beautiful place to live. And so, but we, you know, we had so much fun together. And she started having back pains, and she went to 2 or 3 doctors, and nothing happened, and it kept getting worse. And finally, she got so bad they had to put her in the hospital, and this was in October, and she was diagnosed with bone cancer, and 1 month later, she died. And, you know, my grieving for her was not like for my wife because I didn't feel the same way for that I did. But, you know, and somebody said to me, that's sad. And I said, well, yes, it's part of life and it is sad, you know. But, you know, the way only way I could look at that with and be okay with it is that God gave us 2.5 years of having fun together. We really enjoyed being together. And it was great. It was great. You know, we clicked. We loved to dance. And so it was great. And she went to... She only went to 1 Al-Anon meeting. It was a birthday meeting. And she thoroughly enjoyed it, you know. And we were planning another cruise when she got ill. So things that happen in life, that's the way it goes. I want to tell you a little bit about, I'm probably going to be a little short today, but that's all right. About my life today, I go to meetings. I go to a lot of meetings. As I told you before, I'm going to have to switch my home group, and so I have to go to a lot of meetings to check these other ones out, you know, but I do anyway. I do volunteer work at the Al-Anon office on Mondays. One thing I forgot to tell you that was important in my life, I volunteered in the family program at the treatment center where my wife went through for 10.5 years after she got out, and it was a beautiful experience, and I was telling Marietta that every once in a while, someplace out in the state, I'll run across somebody that says, you know, I met you at Our Lady of Peace, and you told me about Al-Anon. And what a great deal. You know, that's a really, really great deal. I play poker. Sometimes well, and sometimes not so well. I live very close to a world-class senior center, and this is true. And it's in J-Town, Jefferson Town, Kentucky. We have a tournament on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and we play a cash game on Wednesdays. It's a very expensive game. For $2, you get $15,000 worth of chips. So you can really lose your shirt. But as a consequence of this game, I've gone to Las Vegas and to Tunica and other places and played, and I thoroughly enjoy it. You know, I really do. I've got to tell you a little story. I run the poker game at the senior center. Take the money and set up the rules and everything else. And every year, the senior center has a luncheon for the volunteers. And the mayor of J-Town gives us all a certificate of appreciation. And I've gotten 3 of them now. And the last time he told me, he said, please don't tell anybody that I'm giving you this to run a poker game in the senior center. You know, politicians never forget anything. See, I said, man, that'll help you. No, he said, just calm down with that, you know. We still have our family reunion every other year, and it's wonderful. It is truly wonderful. I read a lot. I'm still reasonably healthy for my age. I can't see at night, but other than that, it's okay. God has really been good to me. I consider myself one of the luckiest human beings that I know or have ever known. You know, when I said that at a meeting one time, this lady came up to me afterwards and she said, how can you say that? You know, she said, you know, you lost your son, you lost your wife, you lost your friend. And I said to her, and this I truly believe, I said, you know, that's part of life. We lose people we love. But I love them, and they loved me, and the love is worth the pain. For me, it is. Thank you. I love you all.